This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Facebook's problem with trust. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Revelations that personal Facebook information was misused has put the social media giant on the hot seat yet again. Where does that leave the company?
How parents can end the guilty feelings about missing their child's performances.
A developing trend at bars around the country, axe throwing. Hear how they blend alcohol and sharp objects.
And conflict resolution in an intense political and social media environment.
The world of politics has changed in that it has become a social media conversation. It used to be kind of there was commentary about politics on social media. Now we're using social media to get our information about politics. And so it's really become a completely different platform. And therefore, the way we're using it has become a really different platform.
Ashley Virtue at the National Conflict Resolution Center. She's here in about 25 minutes. You can't put a price on trust, but for Facebook, at least, the lack of it is getting expensive. You'll recall the stock price fell sharply a couple of times this past week, partly because of revelations that user data found its way to a third-party analytics firm that was using the information for political purposes. European Union officials have promised to probe, while several U.S. politicians are calling for the same. What now for the social media giant? Dan Gallagher is a tech writer for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street. Dan, what do you have?
Well, I mean, when you and I don't know if you use Facebook. I use Facebook sometimes. Yeah. You and I go on Facebook. We are essentially the product. We are what Facebook is. What Facebook makes money on is selling to advertisers the idea that advertisers can target their ads effectively because Facebook knows us. They know what you're interested in. They know what I'm interested in. So ideally, they can help show ads that are most relevant and interesting to us. But that comes with trust because as we're interacting on Facebook, you know, we're talking with friends, we're talking with family, sharing, you know, photos, events, these sorts of things. We, the users, have this trust that data is not going to be misused in some way. So when you have stories like this, like the thing that broke over the weekend, you end up with a question of like, okay, what happens to my data? What happens to who knows about me? This arose, incidentally, it arose from a researcher that was doing a project with, you know, those quizzes sometimes we often see in Facebook, like, you know, what kind of potted plant are you? Or what kind of celebrity do you do you seem like? And so, and when you participate in those quizzes, I think a lot of users don't understand that they are actually sharing their data with the companies that are offering these quizzes. And then it turns out that in this particular case, the data actually gave access to friend data. So if you had a friend that did this quiz, your data became visible too. So there was X number of people that participated in this quiz, but because of that, this outfit was able to round up data from something like, I think, 50 million Facebook users, which is a huge number. And so when things like that happen, you know, the users start to think, well, wait a second, is this platform worth my time in participating? Because what happens to, you know, who gets access to what I do and the information that I think is, I don't think people participate in Facebook thinking it's private because obviously you're sharing things publicly, but you don't want to share it so widely that it's available to everybody to make use of.
Mm. I'm speaking with Dan Gallagher. He writes for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street. We're talking about how Facebook could lose friends in high places, something he's written about. You mentioned, too, that one of the concerns here could be that we as users curb our activity on Facebook. What could that mean?
Well, I mean, that cuts to the core of what their entire value proposition is as a business because, you know, one thing they've done really remarkably well is there are now about 1.4 billion people that use Facebook on a daily basis. there's more than 2 million that use it on a monthly basis. You're covering, this company essentially covers roughly one quarter of the human race right now. It's huge, and it keeps growing, and it's consistently growing that number, pretty strongly for years, which is a huge base to grow from. So if people end up starting to doubt about whether, their participation and time on the platform is worth it, if that usage goes down, that in turn makes advertisers think, well, is this a platform I want to spend money on if people are leaving? Because if people leave, then the advertisers start to think, well, maybe I need to put my money elsewhere. And if that happens, Facebook ends up making less money. And they've been a very fast-growing and profitable business up to this point. So that's why you're seeing the reaction on the stock in such a harsh way.
Boy. Anybody predicting that Facebook will one day go away? I know this is not a young people's platform. I mean, really young people, like teenagers, right? This is not their platform.
I haven't heard that. And that's actually, it's a fascinating question when you go out longer term, because like right now, I know teenagers, like to do things like Snapchat. Snapchat's only been around a couple of years though. So, it's an unanswered question to me. Is that kind of a fad for today's teens, and then they graduate to something as they get older, they go to Facebook where a lot of their family and older friends already are? Or do they permanently stick with something they like in high school? I don't think we know the answer to that question. I haven't seen anybody predict that Facebook is going to completely go away. But they do have a vulnerable business in the sense that if it becomes a question of, well, people don't quite trust Facebook, so lawmakers come in with all kinds of rules and regulations about it, you could end up with a business that has a lower growth profile, much higher expenses, has a lot of regulations to deal with. So from an investor standpoint, the risk is that Facebook in 2 years might look a lot different than Facebook right now. And it's hard to know how do you want to value that as an investor.
Thanks, Dan. Dan Gallagher, tech writer for the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street. 13 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, thanks for spending part of your weekend with us, the death of malls is not fake news. There have been only 3 super regional malls, including the one in Sarasota, Florida, built in the United States in the past 8 years. There are now about 1,200 malls in the country, and only half of them are expected to survive the next few years. Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam recently paid a visit to a high-end one to get a feel for what's going on. Alex, what did you experience?
It's funny. I was definitely struck by the number of sale signs, sort of radical 40%, 70%, more than I even mentioned in the column. And I did some journalism, and I talked to a few people. I learned that Apple is doing very, very well in that location, which is interesting. And aside from Apple, no one else seems to be doing all that well.
Wow. And you gave a fair sample, right? I mean, you went in the middle of the week and then you went on a weekend.
Yeah. I mean, viewed from 36,000 feet, obviously, the mall is kind of an endangered species. The estimate is that half of all the malls that are open today will be closed within about 4 or 5 years. And I did mention, and your listeners can easily find the Facebook group called Dead Mall Enthusiasts, which just constantly, is posting pictures of it. And we've all seen them. It's so depressing, these apple orchards that were covered with concrete and now they're completely out of business.
You get the sense that it online shopping is directly to blame here, or is it something else?
I think it's a combination of circumstances, but I think the preponderant cause must be online shopping. I can't speak to your behavior or the behavior of your listeners, but I'm an older person. I'm a baby boomer, and I just use the convenience that Jeff Bezos and Amazon have offered me so often. It's always a decision for me to go to a store. I say, I should support this bookstore. I'm going to go there. I should go to Uniqlo, but it's always a decision, whereas on the internet, it's almost like breathing.
We're speaking with Alex Beam. He's a columnist at the Boston Globe, and he's written a piece entitled Shopping the Two Americas. On the other end of the spectrum, as you point out, boy, they can't build enough Dollar Tree and Dollar General stores fast enough.
The numbers are simply astounding. I don't I don't have them in front of me, but they're both famous stocks, Dollar Tree and Dollar General. They are literally, in one case, I believe it's Dollar Tree, they're literally doubling their store presence. And we're talking about like 600 stores opening each year. Dollar General is larger, but they themselves are opening in the hundreds of stores each year. I live in Boston, and when I drive to New Hampshire fairly often, it is incredible. There are now three Dollar General stores between Boston and central New Hampshire. And as I point out, and this is, it's not an original point, and it's a sad one, but these dollar stores are markers, of course, for people who simply don't have a lot of money.
Yeah. One of the CEOs you spoke to of one of those, I forget which ones, had some damning statement where he said, America is churning out poor people at a record pace, and therefore the need for our stores, something along those lines, right?
Yeah, that was the CEO of Dollar General spoke last year at a financial conference. And, I mean, everybody has made this point. I mean, and Dollar General has almost like sort of apologized in a way. You know, I'm sure your listeners have been in these stores. They're not such great stores. They're not exactly, you know, put together with any particular genius. The fact is that there's just a lot of cheap stuff there. And the kind of people who can afford to subscribe to the Boston Globe, which now costs about $1,000 a year, are really not the kind of people who are on radically limited budgets for food and clothing. Yeah. And people who are on radically limited budgets are shopping at Dollar Tree and Dollar General, and it's you know, it's challenging.
Thanks, Alex. Alex Beam, Boston Globe columnist, and our business update has been brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Parents often agonize when they have to miss a child's big game or stage performance and wonder, is my absence hurting my child? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Can't attend your kid's event? Don't feel guilty. The Wall Street Journal's Sue Schellenbarger says it's a situation that can benefit everyone. Sue, what should you do if you have to miss your kid's game or concert?
Well, it's almost as hard for the parents as it is for the child many times. But if you have a compelling reason to be absent and you can explain it honestly to your child, this is actually an opportunity to instill coping skills and self-reliance in children over the age of 7 or 8.
How do you explain it? And what do you mean by a reliable or some kind of an excuse that is a good one?
It should be something legitimate. If not, you're going drinking with your buddies, or you just never bother to attend your child's events at all out of disinterest. Those are not good reasons. But if you have, for example, a work conflict that's a conference you can't change, a promise you made to an important client, a business trip you just have to make, you can explain to the child in terms they can understand that, you know, you need to contribute to the family income, that your job in the family is to take care of your responsibilities on this job, and the child's job is to go and do a good job playing soccer or performing on the violin or whatever they have to do that day.
Your story profiles a woman who missed a birthday party for a work event. How did she handle that?
She really felt that she wanted to model a realistic sense of responsibility for her 9-year-old daughter, and she said, I made a promise to a client to photograph her wedding. This was a professional photographer, and I need to keep that promise. I will, you know, your father, your grandmother, and your brother will be here to celebrate. But her daughter, a very strong-minded little girl whom I actually spoke to on the phone, she really didn't appreciate that, and she insisted on being angry. And so her mom says, you have a right to be mad. And they didn't cut the cake until mom got home. That turned out to be the next morning because the daughter was already in bed. There was a lot of honesty there, directness, acceptance of negative feelings, and a pretty healthy dialogue, really.
Sue, how does that make your kids stronger in the long run?
Well, for children who can understand it, usually ages 8 and up, they can see a parent doing a realistic job of juggling all their responsibilities. They see the parent doing what they need to do to keep their job. The parent can tell the child, it's important that you perform whether I'm there or not. The parent can get photographs and videos taken to enjoy later with the child. And this actually can instill in the child the desire to do well regardless of who's watching. It's a subtle thing, but many children are ready to learn this at that age.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. Sue, how can you give your kid some kind of role in planning maybe an alternative celebration, or if it's a sporting event, something different that you can do together?
This is a really great approach to say, listen, I feel really bad I have to miss this. How can we plan together to make this work? One mother did this when she had to miss her son's birthday party. He said, could you leave on your business trip a little later so that I can at least see you that day? And she did. She made a later flight. She missed the opening reception at an important conference, but she was able to cook breakfast for her son and give him his gifts early, and that made him really happy. In another case, you can tell the child that you'll watch videos together afterward. I'm really excited we can sit down and watch it together and then ask a friend or family member to record it. It can be almost as fun to savor it together as it would be to watch from the stands.
Sue, what's the problem with a lot of apologies and asking your kid for forgiveness?
This was a problem I always had. I just felt so bad. And I think, I'm so sorry I can't make the soccer game. If you act like this is devastating that you're missing it, then your child is going to think it's devastating too. If you take it in stride and say, hey, look, I have to work. I can't be there, but I'll be thinking about you at 5:30, and I really look forward to talking about it with you about it afterward. I want to hear all about it. This gives another opportunity for the child to see that he or she is important, and also a little practice describing the event for the parent.
That's a good point about the reaction and how you initially bring it up. It's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
If you want the absolute best shirts around, you have to go to CT Shirts. I want you to try them, because once you do, you'll never go back to some random shirt off the shelf of a department store. And CT Shirts come in custom sizes, so you're not messing with ill-fitted sleeve lengths or neck sizes. It's time to step up your game and look your best, so I got you a special CT Shirts deal. 3 CT Shirts for $99. CT Shirts use the softest, most exquisite fabrics ever. Work or casual, tie or no tie, tuck or untucked, when you're wearing a CT shirt, you'll look your best. Here's the deal. 1 CT shirt normally costs $100, but right now you get 3 shirts for just $99. That's 60% off. Go to ctshirts.com/deal. And CT Shirts come with free delivery, a 6-month quality guarantee, and free returns. If you hurry, $99 gets you 3 amazing CT shirts. ctshirts.com/deal. That's ctshirts.com/deal.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate you spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, how average investors responded during the recent stock market roller coaster. Also, the war on drinking straws and gaining popularity now at American bars, axe throwing. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. As you read, see, and hear, online exchanges, from contentious work emails to Twitter to the comments sections on news sites, have become increasingly inflammatory and polarized, with little room for civil, thoughtful discussion. This rhetoric has fed into U.S. politics, which fuels more division and less civility online, and so on in a vicious cycle. The National Conflict Resolution Center is trying to change the tone of the conversations. Here's how, from Ashley Virtue, Director of External Relations at the NCRC. Ashley set this up.
Right now, you know, the world of politics has changed, and that it has become a social media conversation. It used to be kind of, there was commentary about politics on social media. Now we're using social media to get our information about politics. And so it's really become a completely different platform. And therefore, the way we're using it has become a really different platform.
When did it become so nasty?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think we've been dealing with conflict and the idea of civility in the digital age for a long time now, just not necessarily on social media. You know, when email became the way to do business, there was a lot of talk at that time about how are we communicating? How do you read tone in email as opposed to a face-to-face conversation? And we all wondered, how are we going to do this? You know, how are we going to still have good relationships with our colleagues when we can't understand them via email? And then the same thing happened when texting came about. We thought, you know, we're not having phone calls and phone conversations anymore. We're just texting these sometimes important messages to each other, and we're not conveying the right emotions. So the same thing is happening with social media right now, and we're just learning how to communicate effectively on a new platform.
Oh, so that's interesting. Do you think that this is a learning phase for most of us, and that one day we'll be much better communicators when it comes to things like email or texts?
I actually do. I think that people have improved their communication when it comes to email and text. To a certain extent, we have done quite a bit of work actually in companies that, you know, have asked us for a consultation about coming in and helping talk to people about communicating digitally. And so there are people who are investing and wanting to know how to do that more effectively. And so if people take the same time to learn about how to do that with social media and online, there really could be effective and important conversations happening there. And, you know, the thing is that social media and the online world isn't going anywhere. We're going to continue having these conversations that way. So while there will never be a replacement for face-to-face conversations, the thing is we have to learn how to have an online civil dialogue.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Ashley Virtue, Director of External Relations at the National Conflict Resolution Center. Do you find that the anonymity of social media is problematic? If people were more likely to stick their name and job and hometown or something behind it, there would be less problems.
I do. I think there's a lot of bravado that happens behind the computer screen that, you know, sometimes people say or do things they wouldn't in person. And we really encourage people to remember that you are a human talking to another human. And at the end of the day, what happens online isn't always as anonymous as we think either. Just because we're not sitting face to face with someone doesn't mean that a conversation couldn't be recorded or saved for future reference. Yeah. And so, you know, we really have to remember that just because we're not face-to-face does not mean we're not having a conversation with another person.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ashley. Ashley Virtue, Director of External Relations at the National Conflict Resolution Center. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Don't forget, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username at Gordon Deal. During the roller coaster ride for the stock market in January and February, what was your approach to your savings? Did you buy, sell, or sit still? A new survey from Bankrate.com found less than 10% of us actually moved money out of stocks. More on the findings from Taylor Tepper, analyst at Bankrate. Taylor, what'd you find?
So we found that people did pretty much what they were supposed to do when stocks tumbled at the end of January and the beginning of February. We always tell people don't sell just because stocks are going down, and most people didn't. Only 6% sold, which is great news.
All right, so how many did nothing?
So that was really cool. Only 60% intentionally did nothing. So they saw the news and they just flipped on the television, or they went for a walk, or they sort of intuited that just because stocks are falling doesn't mean that this is a time to change your financial plan.
And did the survey indicate that those 60% who did nothing did so intentionally or accidentally and they weren't paying attention?
No, intentionally. They intentionally did nothing. I think another like 1 in 6 or so weren't even aware that this was going on.
Okay.
So that was pretty cool, too. I mean, it's interesting. You don't want people to just start acting on the news, and most people didn't in this case. And maybe it was that the stock market correction wasn't that big of a deal. It was a relatively short period of time. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was that it was caused by good news in the economy that wages were increasing larger than expected or faster than expected. But for whatever reason, people just didn't overreact this time, which is great.
Yeah. It's possible they were seeing other signs within the economy and thinking, okay, this is not really a match, right? I mean, job market's decent, right? All those other good signs.
Yeah, so the economy is doing really, really well. Hiring is up wages are starting to slowly perk up a little bit. Home prices are recovering. People are generally feeling pretty good. And when it comes to stocks, this just shows that Main Street and Wall Street really are separated. People have 401ks, but our survey only found that 43% of people had any kind of investment assets. That includes your retirement investments, individual accounts. And so if the stocks start falling and you aren't a day trader, you aren't owning, you're not trying to get, you know, Facebook up on you, then this is actually really, really, you know, not that big a deal.
Mm. How about some of the emotional measurements you took, like indifference or sadness or fear?
Yeah, 44% of investors were indifferent during the two-week stretch. Maybe that would be different if it was a longer stretch or if the correction was caused by a recession. But because the economy was doing well, people really felt indifferent to this drop. Only about one quarter of people felt sort of bad feelings of either fear or sadness. And 9% were just excited that something was going on.
We're speaking with Taylor Tepper, analyst at Bankrate.com. They've got a survey out that finds just 6% of us were net sellers during the market correction. How about by generation?
Yeah, so it's really kind of what you'd expect. About if you look at millennials, 26% of millennials increased their contributions in this time compared to only 16% of Gen X, 9% of boomers, which is really good because millennials are buying low, and if you're a long-term investor, that means that you're sort of buying into the market at a lower price, and we'll see greater gains.
That's Taylor Tepper, analyst at Bankrate.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. There's a war on drinking straws being declared by a growing group of bartenders, liquor companies, restaurants, celebrities, and environmentalists. They argue too many of the plastic drinking devices, from big soda straws to little cocktail numbers, end up in the ocean. More on what's happening from Wall Street Journal reporter Cara Lombardo. Cara, what's trending?
People are starting to think of plastic straws as a good way to illustrate our reliance on disposable plastics. And so a lot of companies, environmentalists, some celebrities are attaching themselves to the issue of abandoning plastic straws and trying to get restaurants and bars to stop using them.
Wow. How so? What are they doing?
Well, there's a hashtag going around on social media that you might notice. It's hashtag stop sucking, which is pretty catchy. That came from a nonprofit started by the actor Adrian Grenier. And a lot of restaurants are adopting a policy where they're not going to give out straws automatically. They'll wait for someone who orders a drink to ask for a straw. And they're saying that really cuts down on the use because a lot of people don't even notice.
You know, I was thinking as I was reading the story how sometimes the server at, like, just a pizzeria who may bring water, iced tea, or soda just takes a fistful of straws, still wrapped in the paper, and drops them right on the table for everybody to grab.
Yes, exactly. We all have that image of the pile of straws being plopped down at the diner, but that's going to be happening less and less from what I'm hearing.
Wow. All right, so you mentioned, too, there's it's like a bartender consultancy group or something. They actually go and explain to bartenders around the country how to create less waste?
Yeah, I spoke to Claire Sprouse and Chad Arnholtz. They run a bartending consultancy firm. They help bars just get up and running, but they also recently have been focused on sustainability. And straws have become one of their key focuses recently because not only do most bartenders just automatically kind of plop a straw in a drink when they're done making it, but oftentimes they're also using straws to taste the drink as they make it. So by the end of the night, you go through hundreds of plastic straws, and most of them are used for a few seconds only. So they were saying that this is one of the first pieces of advice they give out.
How about that? Are some people just straw enthusiasts and demand a straw maybe in some foo-foo drink or something?
Well, yeah, there's actually a few camps of people who really don't want to give up their straws. There's the obvious one, people who feel from a germ perspective, it's just kind of gross to put your mouth on the rim of a glass where someone else has, where someone else's mouth has been. Even if it goes through the dishwasher, you never know. You see little bits of things hang on. And then there's, you know, women who wear lipstick. That's a very common request that bartenders get. A lot of women will say they need a straw to keep their lip color in place. And then dentists are another group that really promotes the use of straws. They actually would like us all to be using straws behind our front teeth, with the end behind our front teeth, with which very few people actually use it the way that dentists recommend.
You mentioned, too, specifically the Scotch Whiskey Association, weighing in on this?
Yeah, a lot of spirits makers, the Scotch Whiskey Association, Bacardi was one of the first ones to join in on the movement, Diageo, Pernod Ricard have followed. They're all saying at their events and at company events and at events they host for their various brands that they're not going to be using plastic straws anymore. So they've already begun using either paper straws or remaking their cocktails to not require straws.
Thanks, Kara. Wall Street Journal reporter Kara Lombardo. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, what's trending these days in America's bars? Hey, Gletcher with us. So trending at bars these days, axe throwing. ABC News says leave it to the hipsters of Brooklyn to combine craft beer and sharp objects. The first bar in New York City to pick up on the nationwide trend is called Kick Axe Throwing. It's a growing sport that some enthusiasts hope will take off the way bowling did in the last century. Scoring is similar to darts. Playing to the sport's origins at Canadian logging competitions, Kick Axe's decor is reminiscent of a ski lodge, complete with flannel chairs and calfskin carpeting. The perimeter of the venue is lined with cages for throwing. There's a bar serving wine and beer, but no hard liquor. Guests can take a break from throwing axes to play board games like Candyland at tables in the center of the room. While Kick Axe mainly caters to casual players, there are locations across the country where enthusiasts play the sport competitively. One of them is Bad Axe Throwing in Chicago, part of a chain. CEO of Bad Axe, Mario Zelaya, hopes to make axe throwing an Olympic sport. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. No one compliments you when their paycheck is correct, but make one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. With Kronos, we make sure your payroll is done right the first time, from punch to paycheck. Embedded checklists, simplified workflows, a single source of truth. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/payroll. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.